So this is the first talk, and I will begin with a caveat, which is that I'm going to talk too long. Generally, I'd like to talk shorter and have more time for discussion. But I had this idea that it would be good to go through all the pictures tonight and then focus on the last three in the next two talks, because the last three are, in some ways, the hardest to wrap one's mind around. And it also seemed really good to me for us to have the complete picture, the whole overview to begin with, rather than, you know, 3-4-3 or whatever we would do, and then we'd have only part of it as we were going along. And I thought it was this kind of thing, it would help to spell out the whole thing at the beginning. So this talk may be a little bit too long, but my hope is that we can have discussion either during the week or on the next Monday nights, so that we can bring to the fore whatever is on your minds with regard to these pictures. I did send out a reading list, and some of you may have done some reading, and it's fine if you haven't done any. These are the books that I've used, and I'm going to put them in the Dharma shop so that anybody who's coming to the Dharma shop can... You can feel free to come in and use them while you're there. Okay? And then I brought two illustrations. And this one shows them in a circle starting here and goes around like that. And I don't know that you can see it from where you are, but we'll try to do the best that we can. I don't want to say too much about the history of these pictures because you can Google it and it will say it as well as I can. But they've been around, this series of pictures has been around as a tool for teaching in Chan Buddhism in China, which then became Zen in Japan since the 600s. And they became extremely popular, this version by Kuo An Shiyuan, who's known as Kakuen in Japanese, which is a little easier to say, is a version from the 12th century, and that's the version that Paul Reps published in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, which made it well known in the West, in America. This book came out in 1959, first came out in 1959. And the series of pictures went into circulation in Japan very widely in the 15th century. And it was Kakuen's version that became really popular in Japan. It's warm over here, isn't it? And there are several versions of the pictures. There's a set with 5, there's a set with 8, there's a set with 10 that ends with this one, which is number 8 in our set. And there's a set in which the ox gradually starts out black and gradually becomes white. This reminds me of being a Catholic in grade school, where they talk about your soul being like chocolate milk if you were bad. If you were good and you didn't commit sins, no mortal sins, you know, your soul got whiter and whiter. It's kind of interesting to find that in Asian culture. Anyway, in Asia, the ox is... animal commonly used for agriculture, well known and familiar to the people. So this is part of why the ox becomes part of this set of pictures. And, in this set of pictures, the ox is variously a metaphor for enlightened mind and for the untamed mind. I find that a little bit confusing because it is now one and now the other. I think it's more helpful to think of the whole series as a simile for our meditation practice, a simile for what happens when we set out to train, a simile for the progress of Zen training, a simile for the spiritual journey. It lays out, you know, generally speaking, it's laying out how the spiritual journey progresses from beginning to end, so to speak. And the way I like to think of it, well, you could say it illustrates the stages of a practitioner's progression towards purification of mind. That's what the black to white really illustrates. Towards enlightenment, and then his return to the world, or her return to the world. And unfortunately, all these images are men, but and most of us are women, but that's okay. We can make the translation. So the progression on the spiritual journey towards enlightenment, the return to the world, acting out of the wisdom that's gained through that enlightenment. And I like to think of it, because this is my bias, as a journey towards non-duality. From duality and the sense we have of separateness, and that's set up in the dynamic between the person in the illustrations and the ox. So from that sense of duality and separateness towards non-duality, or fundamental wholeness, as this fellow Yamada Mumon calls it. He uses that term, fundamental wholeness, and I, as a description of enlightened mind, really, or of the non-dual mind. And I think there's something quite useful in that way of putting it. So, in a way, this is really a simple and straightforward story, right? You've got this fellow walking around in the landscape, you know, he's walking through the landscape, enjoying himself, and suddenly he notices these tracks, and the tracks lead him to the bull, and he catches the bull and tames the bull and rides home on the bull, you know, or the ox, sorry. I'm using those interchangeably. So, you know, it starts out, you know, everything's kind of fine and hunky-dory, and then he gets caught by this ox and then goes through all the struggle of taming the ox and taking it home. And then the ox disappears, he disappears, and then disappears. And he returns, you know, he eventually returns to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. That's the last picture. So it's, in a certain way, it's that simple, even though that isn't all that simple. And this fellow walking in the landscape, apparently enjoying himself, is already really struggling. Okay, the first picture. Here he is. He looks like a young boy, you know. Kind of out. There's, you know, a waterfall and everything's pretty, and he looks like he's out on a lark. And this first picture, I think of as the arousing of bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind. Okay? And the way that each of these pictures comes with a text, right? There's a short, a prose paragraph and a verse text that goes with each picture that's reproduced in various translations in these books. And reading the various translations can be actually quite instructive. The ways in which they vary from each other, the ways in which they enlighten each other, and the ways in which they actually say the opposite of each other. Anyway, he looks like he's out whistling through the landscape, innocently happy and content, you know. But in fact, according to the text, he's already having a rough time. Anyway, I started out by saying this is the arousing of bodhicitta, or the way-seeking mind. So this is what drives all of our training, according to Buddhist teaching. This mind that longs to walk the way and know the truth. I think of it as the arousing of, or the asking of the question, whatever the question is. And I think of this question as not necessarily having any content. It can take a specific form. It can be a sentence, you know, that we ask of ourselves. But to a certain extent, it's us being questioning. So our whole being, our whole living our whole body is a question. And we may or may not know what the content of that question is, but it's something like, what's going on here? What's it all about? Or what's my purpose in life? What's the meaning of life? What's most important? What's most important to me now? So we, in effect, are the question. And the other way you could describe this is as the great doubt. This is a term we use in Buddhism. The great doubt, which is a non-destructive doubt out of which arises great faith. As we work with that doubt and struggle with it and come to terms with it. You could also think of this as the yearning or the longing that arises in every human being. Which brings us to this great search that we undertake, the religious or the spiritual quest. So you may experience this as a question, or you may just experience it as yearning or longing, or the sense that there's something more, or there's something pulling you forward, or something pulling you deeper. Okay? But what's interesting to me about this picture is that the very first words underneath that picture say, "The ox has never been lost. What need is there to search?" So here we are starting out on our search, and we're told that the ox has never been lost. What need is there to search? So the whole thing gets undercut right at the beginning. Very Zen. And at the same time, we've got to make the change, right? We've got to answer the call, in effect. So, I guess you could say that the situation is that because greed, hate, and delusion have obscured our Buddha nature, we have to refine that Buddha nature. So, in effect, uncover it again. But that's partly to give it away. And in the meantime, we're entangled in greed, hatred, and delusion. And that's the text describes, you know, him being caught in brambles and scratched by thorns and climbing high mountains and crossing wide rivers and getting lost and not knowing which way to turn. And all of that is this entanglement in greed, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons which are the source of our suffering. Okay? So in picture number two, he sees the traces of the ox. So what we've got here is a fellow running after these little tracks here, which are the footprints of the ox. So he's intrigued. He sees, you know, he's out wandering through the landscape. Suddenly he gets a clue. Okay. Now, what this is pointing to is the way in which we find a particular path that we can follow. We orient ourselves within a particular religious tradition or spiritual tradition. So we've got a particular way on which to proceed. So in our Buddhist practice, this would include things like reading the sutras, listening to the teachings and putting them into practice, and doing the specific practices of the tradition, like our meditation practice or keeping the precepts. Okay, so you have this unknown tradition that's guiding you and supporting you on your way. So those tracks are leading you towards what it is that you're searching for. Okay, and they're a bit of a clue to what it is you're going to find. So the tracks are not the ox, but they're a clue to the nature of the ox or the nature of the search. Okay. In the same way, our practice doesn't cause enlightenment, but without it, there is no enlightenment. So we found a framework for the search and for answering the question or responding to this yearning that we are experiencing. A method or a way for fulfilling our aspiration. And at this point, perseverance and patience are essential. So those are the qualities that you need to carry on at this point. The text says, these traces can no more be hidden than one's nose. And this is pointing us to the fact that enlightenment is really right here, completely visible to us. So then the conundrum is, so why aren't we seeing it? And as in the first picture, there's this hint of that there's nothing to acquire, only the uncovering of what it is that we seek. But there's nothing that we don't already have, just like we have our nose on our face. The third picture is glimpsing the ox. So what we've got here is the little fellow and some landscape, and the ox is disappearing into the underbrush, the shrubbery, the, you know, briars and brambles. So depending on what we want to think of the ox as symbolizing, we could say that this is catching a glimpse. You know, you sit down in meditation, and one of the first things that happens is you discover how unruly and wild your mind is. So this is catching a glimpse of the beast of the unruly mind, the problematic mind, the mind that's upset and distressed and stressed and all of that stuff. Or you can think of it as catching a glimpse of Buddha nature, if you think of the ox as representing Buddha nature. So, and all of the commentaries on this picture talk about this picture referring to the initial enlightenment experience that one has. In some ways, that catapults you way down the road, you know. But I think it can be helpful to think of the glimpse of the ox as a glimpse of some kind of understanding that reinforces for you the value of the teachings and practice that you began following in the second picture. So some kind of insight appears. I mean, you know, the commentaries talk about Kensho and Satori and big enlightenment experiences and things like that. But I think it can be really helpful to think of this as some kind of insight occurs that reinforces the sense that you're on the right path. And that the meditation practice, the keeping of the precepts, the teachings of the Buddha actually help. Okay. The way that Kensho or Satori is described in the commentaries is as one has a perception of unity. The verses say like salt and water. So it's the beginning of the recognition that we're not as separate as we thought we were. Okay. The fourth picture, catching the ox, with great stress, struggle, effort, straining, and all of that, the fellow gets a lasso around the ox and is, you know, wrestling him to the, not quite to the ground, but to stillness at least. Okay, so this is a period of a time in our training and practice of great struggle, striving, and overt effort. You know, this kind of effort. Okay, that's hard work, and sometimes oppressive and makes us want to quit. What we're trying to do here is actualize the insight that we had in the third picture. And this means keeping a rein on the heart mind, that heart mind that we saw in meditation that was so wild, keeping a rein on it and trying to begin to train it. Okay? So, and at this stage, this isn't an easy task. It takes a lot of struggle and effort. The verse says, his, meaning the ox, his will and power are inexhaustible. Longing for sweeter grass, he wanders away. His mind still is stubborn and unbridled. If I wish him to submit, I must raise my whip. So this is the training of breaking old habits of mind and heart and trying to reframe them. And, you know, longing for sweeter grass, you know, the mind is constantly going off somewhere and we're constantly needing to bring it back, you know, to the stillness of the meditation, to being present, to being right here. Okay? The fifth picture is taming the ox. So this shows him leading the ox by a halter and the ox is following quietly behind. Can you all see these at all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, good. There he is. Yeah. So the ox is being led by a halter. So with training, the ox or the mind settles down and follows the master naturally. And as the ox becomes gentler, we learn to trust ourselves. Because, well, in part because we're seeing that we can actually train this ox, which is in fact a part of ourselves. And one of the things that you can see in these pictures is the relationship between the ox and the person could be construed as a kind of master-disciple relationship or teacher-student relationship. And I think the direction that goes in as you go through the pictures is that we discover that the master and disciple are both within. So as we tame the ox, we become more able to trust ourselves, trust our training and our intuition as to what is helpful in our training and how to proceed. One of the commentators talks about this picture as post-satori practice. And he talks about it in terms of working meditation. We would call it working meditation, but also every minute meditation. The moment-to-moment mindfulness that our practice entails. So bringing the meditation practice into our everyday life and using it to support everything that we're doing. And out of this comes compassion, because as we work in our lives, we're working with others. So compassion begins to appear as we do that work based in our meditation practice and based in that stillness of mind and based in the kindness that naturally arises from that stillness. Okay? So the initial insight that we had is a lovely thing, but it's followed by a lot of work. And that's the work of the day-to-day practice and training, the continually bringing our mind back, bringing our mind back to full awareness in the present moment right now. Okay? And that's what sustains insight and brings it alive and enables it to make a difference in our lives. Otherwise, insight is just this neat thing that happens, you know, while we're sitting in meditation, but it doesn't go any further than that. And it has no, well, sustaining power is what I'd say. You know, it's forgotten the next day or the next week or whatever, and doesn't become an active force in our lives. But when we can do this work of minute-to-minute meditation in our lives, then the insight can unfold as we interact with our world. And that enriches it and makes it a living part of who we're being and how we're practicing and training. Okay? At this point, we can begin to relax a little. You know, the ox is being a little quieter, and the training requires a lot of vigilance, but we can be more relaxed within that vigilance, so that sense of really striving type of effort begins to... relax. It eases. That's the word I'm looking for. So there's a sense of tranquility that begins to develop. Okay, the sixth picture is riding the ox home. So he's sitting on top of the ox, doesn't even seem to have the reins in his hand. The ox seems to know where to go. He's at ease on the ox and he's playing the flute. So this is seems pretty nice after all that stress and struggle and strain. He's just hanging out playing the flute and everything's hunky-dory and they're headed home. I think it's interesting that they're going home and not somewhere else. I mean, if you think of home, not just as your house where you live, but the place where you're at home, where your heart's at home, your heart and mind are at home. So this is a stage of real ease and effortless activity. Relaxation amidst the difficulties of life and of practice and training. the actual insight that one can relax and be at ease even within that which is difficult, which is really a wonderful thing. The verse that goes with this says, the whole world is a Buddha world. So we can see how gradually the sense of separateness and duality begins to be undermined and collapsed. You know, before it was a big struggle. You're looking for something you can't find. You find it, it's tough. You know, it's hard work. Now the whole world begins to appear as a Buddha world. There's nothing to be bothered about. And the sense of unity is supported by the sense of this person and the ox living and acting as one. You know, he doesn't even need the reins. The ox just knows where to go. And the verse says, onward I go, no matter who may wish to call me back. And on the one hand, this speaks to getting to the point where our practice is, we've embodied the practice enough. It's become enough of who we are that it's reflexive. So nothing distracts us from it. So no matter who calls us back, we're not distracted from the mind that keeps us within our practice. To me, it also means that there's a place in the spiritual journey where we can't turn back, where you've gotten yourself in deep enough that you can't decide, no, I don't want to do this, and go back to where you were. You have to keep going. It becomes, in a way, not a choice anymore, even though it is, of course, always a choice. Okay. Then the seventh one, he's hanging out in front of his house, and there's no ox in the picture. This is ox forgotten. So, just the person, no ox. This is where ego gets out of the way, or self is forgotten. Okay, so this unruly, crotchety ego that keeps us, is, you know, the self-partiality. Somebody used that phrase today. Did you say that today, Andy? Somebody said self-partiality. And I think of that, you know, as this a wonderful phrase for this, you know, being controlled and run by the selfish self and our concern with ourself. And I am the center of the universe and all of that. All of which, you know, Buddhism works so hard to break down, this sense that of a separate self, and it's important, and that and it's what matters, and it's what drives everything we do and creates all of our suffering. So that self is forgotten by the time we get to this picture. There's no need to search. The search itself comes from the self, and the search itself is a source of suffering. And this can be, I think, very counterintuitive. But the fact that we think there's something we don't have and there's something I've got to get and there's something to attain and there's a goal to get to creates distress. It serves a good purpose at the same time. So, you know, as it often in not just in Zen, but in any really religious matter, you have this paradox. On the one hand, the search is utterly necessary. And on the other hand, it's the source of suffering itself. And we search because the self wants something it thinks it doesn't have. So at this point, with the self dropped away, there's no need to search. Or we could think of this in terms of Buddha nature being superfluous. Who needs Buddha nature when the Buddha mind is functioning unseen, as Buddha does? So Buddha mind naturally functioning, which is what we're all doing anyway, is fine as it is. And you don't need a concept called Buddha nature that you need to get to or discover. Is this making sense? Okay. So, you can have some serenity and some tranquility. You know, you can just relax in front of your house. Repose. Dogen says, meditation is the Dharma gate to repose and joy. So here we are at this stage in our meditation practice, if we think of this as a metaphor for our meditation practice, at the stage of repose and joy. The distress and suffering of the search are over. I think of this as the stage of not to, because the ox, the self, have dropped away. and there's nothing outside of ourselves to search for. And that points to the fact that, as I was alluding to earlier, the whole journey really takes place within our own heart. We can pictorialize it as external to ourselves, but it's really something that goes on within. And at the same time, not without the interaction of our fellow practitioners and our friends who encourage us and support us and lend insight to what we're doing. Again, Yamada Mumon says in his commentary, if you think life has a purpose, you still haven't arrived. And I like that comment. You know, he goes on to say that when you arrive, you play. But if you think life has a purpose, you haven't arrived because you're still divided. There's still you and the purpose, and you're trying to get to the purpose or manifest the purpose. Okay, so seventh picture is not two. The eighth picture, man and ox forgotten. This is the empty circle. And you could even say that drawing a circle is too much, that it's really a blank piece of paper when you get here. Ox and self forgotten. Everything's dropped away. Body and mind have dropped off. It's also called seeing the source of the mind. So to me, this is our meditation mudra, by the way. This circle, this empty circle, okay? Seeing the source of the mind. This is where we get to the point of non-duality, okay? What we set out to get to in the first place, to whatever extent you can get to it. This is the realization of emptiness with a capital E, that Japanese word shunyata. And we'll talk more about this next week when we talk about 7 or 8 and 9 together. So I'm going to kind of glance over this now. It may not make a lot of sense, but we'll come back to it. This is so full realization of emptiness, right? The complete falling away or dropping off of body and mind. That's how Dogen described it. There's no practitioner, no goal, nothing to seek, nothing to do, no awakening, no Dharma, no self, no Buddha, no nothing, no anything. There's nothing from the beginning, it's sometimes said. And in the verse, it says, how can a snowflake exist in a raging fire? And I love that image. How can a snowflake exist in a raging fire? This is really hard to put into words. And that way of putting it, how can a snowflake exist in a raging fire? If you begin to explain it, you kind of lose it, you know? You just have to take the image. And when you experience something like this, it all makes perfect sense. The empty circle, the no Dharma, no Buddha, no nothing, you know, it comes to life. Now, picture 9 is called returning to the source, which is also what picture 8 is. Picture 8, ox and self forgotten, is returning to the source. And this is just a nice, pretty, peaceful landscape right here. No ox, no person, but a lovely landscape. And I see these two pictures as opposite sides of the same coin. In this picture, you've got nothing, and in this picture, you have everything. Reverend Master Juke said, emptiness was the fullest, or shunyata was the fullest emptiness she's ever known. A full emptiness. This, think of it as like space. Space is so empty and so huge, it contains everything. And this is the expression of it with nothing, and this is the expression of it with everything. Okay, so everything disappeared. Now that everything's come back, here
we see things. I mean, everything was in these other pictures too, right? But here, nothing is obstructing. So everything's there. Nothing's obstructing. All these brambles and bushes and thickets and shrubbery and mountains and rivers that were a problem in the beginning are now aids and teachers. And that would do as well for other human beings. It's very easy to forget about other human beings. And other human beings can be our biggest teachers because they can also be our biggest obstacles. But when you've gotten to this stage of the journey, all that sense of obstacleness drops off. And there's, you know, access to... access, I was about to say access to whatever it is that all things have to teach us, but it's even better than that, isn't it? Because it's just really access to each other's hearts. Yeah? At this stage, it's said in the commentaries, we're naturally compassionate. Compassion arises within the course of daily life without our thinking. Oh, I'm going to be compassionate. Oh, I'm going to help. Oh, I'm going to be kind. However we construe that. It just is how our being is. Okay? And this isn't evident from the picture itself, but at this point we're beginning the descent from the mountain. If you think of the mountain, you know, as the empty circle, you know, the kind of, you get to the mountain, the top of the mountain, and the work is over and the view is ecstatic. But then you come down to the mountain, to the tenth picture, which is returning to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. And in this picture, it's often called, something like returning to the marketplace with open hands, something like that. I like bliss bestowing. Maybe I'm a bliss junkie. In any case, in this picture, there are two people, unlike any of the others. And the little fellow who started out in picture number one kind of innocently walking in the landscape has become this fat monk carrying a traveling staff and a big sack on his back. And this is a depiction of Maitreya, one form that Maitreya appears in. Maitreya is the future Buddha in Buddhist teaching. And he's interacting with a little fellow. Some say this little guy is a beggar. Could be. But the point is that this being on this spiritual journey has returned to the marketplace and is now offering things by being who he is. Just by being who he is, really. That's what his sack is full of, things that he... you know, toys for children and things like that. And the commentaries say, you know, that we come down from the mountain back to involvement with our lives, you know, with our relationships, with our work, with the people around us, with daily life, with, you know, washing the dishes and mowing the lawn and everything else that we do, raising our kids and we're the same as we were when we started, but completely different. So there's a way in which here Maitreya obviously looks different, but the idea of this is that you return to your ordinary daily life, not looking any different than you were, but something inside has been completely rearranged. The verse says, "I am ragged and dust laden, and I am ever blissful." We become the teachings of the Buddha manifesting in the world. That's where all this is going. And John Dido Laurie in his book here says that he thinks that for us this is particularly important because we are the appearance of Zen in the West. So whatever spiritual journey we undertake and wherever it leads us is how we offer Zen teaching and practice in the West, and that can be very formative for how Buddhism comes to the West. I thought that was an interesting
take on his part, actually. But in any case, we become Maitreya, bestowing benefit on all we come in contact with because of who we've become. And the thing about Maitreya in this rendition is that he's got this big grin on his face. He's always smiling and laughing. And in a way, he bestows benefit on all simply by enjoying himself and others. But to me, it suggests that the end of the spiritual journey, if you could say there was an end, is joy, unutterable joy. That having gone through the briars and the brambles, joy is what we come out with. So that's the 10 pictures, quick and dirty. I hope that sort of gives you a sense of the arc or the trajectory of the journey. You know, think of this as a spiritual journey, and from a Zen point of view, that's the trajectory of it. I think that this depiction in a circle is interesting and helpful because I think we do this more than once in our lives. And I think a little bit like the Noble Eightfold Path, you know, we talk about the Noble Eightfold Path as being a path with these steps, but in fact we're working on all the steps all at once. And in many ways we're working on all of these pictures all at once. There can be one big overarching journey, but within that there are littler ones going on, littler circles that we're making, and that we repeat the big journey and the little journeys many times in our life. And the question takes a different form. The question that we begin with, or the aspiration we begin with, we may put different words to it. It may take a different form in the context of our lives. You know, it may appear differently to us when we're young and starting a career and raising little children, and it's different when we're older, that sort of thing. But I think it's really helpful not to think of this as a linear, straight line thing where we begin and end, and we've started with nothing and we've ended with something and we've reached our goal. I think the whole point of this is to undermine that way of thinking about it, actually. So I find that circle helpful. Now, one other thing I just want to say a little bit about, if I can. When I was studying these pictures in preparation for these talks, I read Joseph Campbell's book, A Hero with a Thousand Faces. And I had not read or seen any Campbell before this. I kind of missed the whole Campbell thing in the 80s. I was in Asia. I was overseas. And I missed it. I didn't have a TV set when I was here. I missed it. So I read this book and my jaw was on the ground. I mean, this guy is really good. So it was a whole awakening for me. But, you know, I had this sort of intuitive sense, you know, that this journey that's depicted in these Oxfording pictures is not unrelated to the hero's journey that Campbell talks about in this book from so many different religious and spiritual traditions and mythological traditions. All these hero's journeys that he talks about and you know, present, he gives, I'm assuming you've all read it and are familiar with it, but you know, he sees the hero's journey and let's say heroine as well. You know, because hero can sound very male, and the hero's journey can sound very male. Women have their version of this too, and we're all engaged in this in our lives. And it takes a particular kind of form. And so I just want to say a little bit about that Campbell's hero's journey, the basic outline is the hero's dissatisfied with things at home. He or she can't tolerate the status quo, knows there's got to be more, and goes out searching, looking for something, not necessarily knowing what. Has many adventures and encounters, many extremely difficult obstacles, including, you know, pain, rejection, despair, extreme danger, and even death. And in many of the hero's journeys, the hero or heroine actually does die, and then they're usually resurrected in some way, right? Finally, the hero or heroine conquers the last obstacle and beholds whatever it is, the Holy Grail, God, the nectar of the gods, you know, the
He calls it the great boon. Okay, I kind of like this word boon, that the hero, heroine finds some boon that he or she takes home and shares with their people. And then they live happily ever after, you know, married to the princes or whatever. Living an ordinary life, you know, returning to the marketplace. Now, something that's been really crucial to me in my training, and oddly, Jim and I, you said something about this last night at our potluck, that I've been really, it's been really in my face how the terrifying, the horrible, that which we can't tolerate, that which we can't stand, the point of our religious practice isn't to get rid of that stuff. It's to hold it along with the good, the wonderful, the happy, the joyful. It's not, you know, duality is to set up those opposites and get rid of one and keep the other. And then you spend all your life trying to make sure the one doesn't happen and the other does. To me, that's a definition of suffering. And we find the end to suffering really when we come to all acceptance. I mean, we say this all the time in our tradition. And we can hold both of those things at once, right? So the terrible and the terrifying along with the blissful and the wonderful held together at once. And it's interesting because the verse to the ninth picture, this one, says, poised in silence, I observe the forms of integration and disintegration. So in a sense, it's kind of Hindu. You've got to take the destruction along with the creation. If you're going to have the creation, the destruction is going to happen. Because we're dealing with a living system, right? And the way that Campbell talks about this is he says, the passage of the mythological hero may be overground. That is, he's, you know, where the hero is walking through geography, right? Fundamentally, it's inward, into depths where obscure resistances are overcome. We all know about that, right? Our resistances. And long-lost, forgotten powers are revivified to be made available for the transfiguration of the world. He has really powerful language, Campbell. This deed accomplished, life no longer suffers hopelessly under the terrible mutilations of ubiquitous disaster, battered by time, hideous throughout space. See, I think part of this journey is actually recognizing how hideous it is. And that's, of course, what we're all trying to avoid, is having to have that recognition. Campbell continues, but with its horror visible still, its cries of anguish still tumultuous, it becomes penetrated by an all-suffusing, all-sustaining love and a knowledge of its, that's love's, own unconquered power. So I think that's a very powerful way of putting it, you know, that it's, the anguish is still tumultuous, but it's suffused by an all-sustaining love. And a recognition of the power of that love. And it occurs to me that this is really important in our modern world and our attempts at a spiritual life within it. Because we so often talk now about how horrific things are out there. The whole global warming thing in itself is just a nightmare of a mess, right? And if we think about what could happen, it's just overwhelming. Along with, you know, disease and starvation and all, you know, the whole catastrophe. And, you know, our instinct is to make it better, to go out and fix it in some way, to find a cure for AIDS or work out how we can feed people or how can we reduce carbon emissions. And all of those approaches, I think, are really necessary. We have to do them. It's not about not doing those things. But I also think that we can get caught in the opposites.
you know, we've got to get rid of this so that everything will be fine, right? And I've been wondering if the solution actually isn't something different from what we've imagined up till now. And I don't know that I know what that solution is, but I think it may have to do with what Campbell was pointing to, holding in love all the horror of it and all the beauty of it at once. And I'm wondering if perhaps that's what these pictures are about for us now, living in 21st century world, not just America, but world.